Essay number 4. Memory is a kind of accomplishment. Part 1. Row, row, row your boat gently down the stream. Merrily, 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 life is but a dream. I could have used Heraclitus's famous dictum, "You never step in the same river twice," to open this piece. But these simple lines from a famous children's ditty feel more pertinent to and more generative for my overall purposes. Obviously, I get dream into the picture this way, a big plus. But that's not the reason I picked it. It was more because this image is founded on our interactive relationship with the stream. Human agency integral to the narrative. All of that personal exertion, keeping us afloat along an extended timeline, which is what life is and how we best live it. When you row, you navigate. Okay, it may be down the stream, the only direction time moves in our universe, but the path is somewhat self-directed, not accidental. In the context of that song, you and the boat are like needle and thread, the river cloth, creating a traceable seam. In Heraclitus's vision, you can certainly step in and out of the river as often as you want, a sort of narrative sequence. But it's not progressive, like trying to sew without thread. The cloth moves, the needle pokes, nothing connects. Sooner or later, I intend this to be an essay about memory, how it functions. Primarily because I want to write once again, I have multiple times previously, about one of my favorite William Carlos Williams poems, The Descent. I have no idea yet how I'm going to get there, but I am certain that this boat on that stream is where I want to start. I appreciate the addition of merriment to the equation, too, always a good thing. Merriment may not be an inevitable derivative of personal agency, but asserting some control over one's passage often makes it more enjoyable. Heraclitus is many, many things. Merry is not one of them. I like merry, and I like gently. Similar set of reasons. Again, not Heraclitus's jam. Then finally, there is the astonishing closing proclamation that life is but a dream. Most kids probably don't question that much, their experience in the temporal world having an inbuilt dreamlike quality to it. But to have reached my age and find myself instinctively acceding to that characterization of a life, well, that's kind of stunning. The but is especially intriguing. Life is not like a dream, a shallow simile. And it is not simply and exactly a dream, a kind of simpy platitude. There is something casually dismissive about the but that gives the whole picture the right flavor for me, lowering the temperature of the ongoing challenge. All that row, row, rowing, suddenly becoming more merry and gentle. If you've ever rowed a boat down a stream, you know the ways instinct and body interact autonomically. Most often skipping past conscious deliberation. You go with the flow as you do in a dream. Or you don't go far. It just struck me that I can use the term stream as it pertains to consciousness as a next move toward my main theme, memory, via the now commonplace phrase stream of consciousness. One rooted more rigorously in the European surrealism of the 1920s. A movement favoring the abandonment of rational control over the activity of the image-making, word-generating mind. Just letting the powerful currents that swirl beneath awareness, what they and their contemporaneous psychologists called the unconscious, generate their immediate truth for the conscious mind to then consider and explore, if not fully understand. Going with the flow, but without a paddle. You can, or at least I will here because I think it's pertinent, trace the roots of this inner liberation all the way back to the concept of association, a emergent in the 18th century, which became central to the Romantic poetic method. Among British writers, it is foundational, for example, to Wordsworth. See his preface to the Lyrical Ballads. And most especially to Coleridge, who borrows his version of the concept from his friend, the proto-psychologist David Hartley, and uses it most vividly in his beautiful conversation poems, which generally open with a simple image that the process of association then riffs down an emotional circuit via previously disconnected memories until the original image reappears in a transubstantiated form at the close. It all feels, even for the reader, like row, row, rowing down a stream of consciousness that subsurface oar strokes via images or words punctuate. Except in this case, the stream circles back to where it starts. A physical impossibility in nature where you can't go downhill all the way back to where you started. But two of the places you can do that are in dreams and in memories. So now, I guess my theme memory is afloat and on its merry way via the very process of row, row, rowing I opened with. The added bonus being that I can see it in relationship with or as analogous to dreaming. I'll need to come ashore for a while to think about where I want to row next. Part 2. For some reason, my head keeps coming back to a dream-based term that I know little about, but have long been curious toward. The Australian Aboriginal concept of the dream time. So I just spent a good part of this morning reading and watching YouTubes about it. The first thing I learned is that the word dream time, one concocted by a 19th century anthropologist, Francis Gillen, working from a Western perspective, is not an entirely accurate translation from the Aboriginal languages in that, for them, it has nothing whatsoever to do with either time or dreaming. Can't beat that Western perspective for row, row, rowing boats down the wrong stream. This reminded me of T.S. Eliot's critique of Wordsworth's famous statement that poetry is emotion recollected in tranquility, which Eliot calls an inexact formula, for it is neither emotion nor recollection nor without distortion of meaning tranquility. Gillen's term, which in keeping with Western colonial privilege has been globally accepted as the go-to name for what the Aboriginals believe and do, is similarly inexact in that it is all wrong in all of its aspects. A somewhat more accurate translation of what the Aboriginals believe and do as it pertains to time is everywhen, the timeless state that serves as the context and foundation for everyday temporal experience, circular and cyclical, always returning to its source, the way water flows only in dreams and in memories. Another possible translation is eternal, uncreated, which, like everyone, seems to me to be akin with the Taoist concept of wei, that generative tissue from which everything extant issues and returns, a fluid process we can witness and participate in via the activity of ordinary perception. Both these notions row me further down my preferred stream here in that they seem applicable to my own experience, or at least sensation, of what nighttime dreaming feels like. The customary strictures of time and space cease to apply. In the average dream, while it may contain certain elements from my first-hand experience via memory, never, ever replicates that exactly, or most often even remotely. Usually it's just the opposite. The details of some dreams seem to have been drawn from a reservoir other than my personal, conscious memories. They look that unfamiliar. What all of that nightly invention and recreation is for eludes me, as it has dream theorists throughout the ages. Neuroscientists now have at least a rudimentary idea about how our conscious memories are acquired and stored. And like you, I have an existential sense of what it feels like to have an inventory of such memories, which constitute not only my personal past via first-hand experience, but also the extrinsic pasts that contextualize those experiences, assembled via various kinds of conscious study, or assimilated without much scrutiny from the cultural water I swim in. I also have a sense of how I remember some of my nighttime dreams, far less than 1% of them, via the note-taking and subsequent reflection I've described in my writing. But what, I wonder, happens to the 99%+ of those vivid dreams that I don't remember consciously? Do they end up as memories of a sort as well? That's where the dream time, or slightly more acceptably to the Aboriginals, the dreaming, comes in, at least tangentially. The stories and songs comprising the reservoir of cultural memories that Aboriginals experience via various kinds of rhythmic activities, intense dancing, drumming, music, are not simply learned elements of their cultural past, nor are they either history or myth. They are contemporaneous, embodied memories constitutive of their identities, which in some respects don't exist outside of that rich contextual web. The closest analogy to this that I can think of in Western psychology is Jung's collective unconscious, which he believed was a sort of broadly cultural ancestral reservoir of meaningful symbology that sheathes and supports the more traditional Freudian personal unconscious. I'm not a big fan of either Freud or Jung, but Jung's concept at least implies the possibility that individual memory is more than the sum of its autobiographical parts. Here's what Jung has to say about this in The Significance of Constitution and Heredity in Psychology in November 1929. And the essential thing, psychologically, is that in dreams, fantasies, and other exceptional states of mind, the most far-fetched mythological motifs and symbols can appear autochthonously at any time, often, apparently, as the result of particular influences, traditions, and excitations working on the individual, but more often without any sign of them. These primordial images, or archetypes, as I have called them, belong to the basic stock of the unconscious psyche and cannot be explained as personal acquisitions. Together, they make up that psychic stratum that has been called the collective unconscious. The collective unconscious comprises in itself the psychic life of our ancestors, right back to the earliest beginnings. It is a matrix of all conscious psychic occurrences, and hence it exerts an influence that compromises the freedom of consciousness in the highest degree, since it is continually striving to lead all conscious processes back into the old paths. This suggests how I may have memories that are not entirely my memories, which is what remembered dreams often feel like to me, both mine and not mine. Last night, for example, I had a series of dreams over multiple REM cycles that were quite disturbing, vaguely rooted in autobiographical moments or details, but for the most part, more like surrealistic inventions. In one of them, Humphrey Bogart and another man were slathering raw ground beef about 2 inches thick on the lower half of a big car, like a 60s Cadillac, to create what Bogart called a suicide machine for himself and his wife. Then they had a number of misadventures in that car, which I won't document here, though I know that none of them led to the death of either. The only material that came directly from my personal memory was the setting, my hometown, the hill behind our house, which was the launch point for the car. That was just one of the REM cycles. I don't recall the exact details of the dreams that followed, though they generally had to do with cars and roads and misadventures, all equally wacky, including one with a large steamroller flattening a car. None of these images are even remotely ancestral archetypes, or even most likely symbols. I'd have to defer to Jung on that matter. But their source is ambiguous. In other words, they were both mine and not mine, remembered and unremembered, with meanings I found almost entirely elusive. I was very happy yesterday, unusually so, and very calm, unusually so. Yet for some reason, my brain invested an enormous amount of its creative energy last night generating these wild and unnerving dreams. Why? I have no way to answer that definitively, except that it now allows me to think about memory in a more complex way, as a faculty with perhaps multiple layers and parts, some of which, one, are conscious, like those we create and store during our waking periods, often turning them into story. Two, are unconscious, that is, fully hidden, unless we do a lot of work on them, like what culture inculcates in us and critical theory attempts to make visible, or that haunt our dreams and depth psychology strives to decode. Or three, are essentially extrinsic to our personal identity center, belonging to different times and places. What I like about the Aboriginal approach to the everyone is that it makes this last group express and normal, shared in waking time via stories and song, available anytime to anyone. Not at secondhand, darkly, via dreams, or brightly, via crafted artifacts, which in Western systems tend to isolate the active maker from the passive audience and to commodify rather than sanctify the medium of exchange. The everyone not only contributes to personal identity, but makes personal identity possible in the first place. Shifting the power dynamic between inside and outside considerably in the favor of the latter. It is, in fact, via embodied activity, dancing, singing, drumming, didgeridooing, that the everyone is engaged, entered. And in the ecstatic moments of contact, the individual identity center is subsumed into a broader identity that both includes and redeems it. Such dreams become, by this means, both a way of living and a mode of active learning. I'm not in any way saying or implying that my dreams have anything to do with the Aboriginal everyone. Their culture certainly didn't start with a hamburger-coated Cadillac pushed off a hill in Forest City, Pennsylvania, kamikazeing into the outback with Humphrey Bogart and his wife aboard. They have much more beautiful and plausible stories to account for all that. But I have had a number of experiences, both waking and sleeping, with dreams that could not possibly have arisen entirely on the basis of my personal wakeful life events. Some may be questionable in that regard, like the sequence of four dreams I report in I'm Into Something Good. But some are not, like the free dream I used to conclude this fall, far too long and complex to add here, or to have arisen in that form and detail on my own initiative. Or the phantom thespian dream I used to conclude Harvest, originating a concept I could never have come up with on my own. These dreams simply exceed my creative capacity as an isolated organism. On the waking side, the little snippets of images that opened a way to my Froth of Bubbles essay, upcoming later in this book, or my Chinese field story in last spring, are on the questionable side too. There are, though, several other quite extraordinary events that happened while I was wide awake that I never tell anyone about, fearing the generic you-believe-in-UFOs effect that clearly weren't. the questionable groups could possibly be accounted for in the context of traditional Western ideas about individual identity, a sort of creative unconscious. The others can't. Jung's collective unconscious works there, but awkwardly. Everyone works better, but still awkwardly. So I'm left wondering. Part 3. I've written repeatedly about the way the creative work I've generated in the aftermath of my wife's passing has seemed simply to come to me out of the blue. Where the blue is either an inner sky I am floating down through, or an outer sky I am flying up through. Unconscious or visionary, take your pick. I do the work, but it is quite unlike what work was prior to that event, which I believed was genuinely mine, both in the process, quite diligently practiced, and the product, which I felt warranted my name as author. Think and write was the discourse that applied. This more recent work is simply and obviously, to me at least, not mine in those ways. I describe the strange sensation I experienced while making these artifacts, essays, poems, songs, variously along the way, most recently in I'm Into Something Good, the sense that I simply provide the synapses and the fingertips to produce the material. In other words, I feel and I type. It is, I have admitted all along, possible that most of that can be accounted for by a traditional unconscious. All of these artifacts, like long, complex dreams I am having while I sit staring at a blank computer monitor. Perhaps the switching mechanism that typically separates dream time from wake time got retoggled, oddly, by the trauma of my loss. That would explain, I guess, why I seem to dream so much more, or at least remember so many more dreams than other readers of my work. And it would explain the sense of disconnect I feel between what's happening in my head while I write, almost nothing, and what I type up. In this scenario, I might say that my inner apparatus, what I name my brain in I'm Dreaming My Life Away, is simply trying to help me get righted again. To get that switched returned to its normal state, on while I sleep, off while I'm awake. All of its background work hidden properly in the background where it belongs. It generates these artifacts primarily, if not exclusively, for me to learn what I need to know now, which, as I've also said repeatedly, is what I try to do with them. If there are other ears to hear out there willing to listen, all the better. But not essential is what I think it thinks. But as I said, there is a small part of it that just doesn't fit that paradigm. That to me comes from somewhere else, somewhere outside of me. I've used the word ecstatic quite often to describe my relationship with this outside, a word that has outside built into its etymological roots. I bear witness in that realm, then do my best to relay it all back to myself and any willing others who might have ears to hear it. It is, I expect, at least potentially, a much deeper reservoir of meaning than I have been able to tap along the way, awesome in both the beautiful and scary senses. I am so grateful for the gift, my little dip into the shallows of that ocean has given me. The capacity to keep afloat, head above water, whatever. Too much of it would drown me, and I'm glad it all came late enough in my life to allow me to do the more normal work I needed to do along the way to hold down a job, get paid, raise a family, etc., which I am similarly grateful for and actually prouder of, because it took hard work to accomplish all that. Now I mostly just walk and then type, two pretty easy things. Had I been born into a culture with a healthier relationship to that outside, And the American version of the Western operating system is, in that regard, one of the worst. I would have been able to inhabit both realms, comfortably and appropriately, the way it seems to me, based on my infinitesimally small bit of research, the Aboriginals in Australia do. All of it would seem to be of a piece. The daily survival, the dance. Identity from the outside in. No need for a switch to toggle. Just go with the flow, gently down the stream. I'll close this section with this weird and funny dream I had last night, one that has no particular value in relation to any of what I've written here, but that somehow, I'm not sure how, allowed me to feel and type all of this today. So in this dream, I get a call from a neighbor named Mitch saying there was a local realty covenant that allowed him to claim my house by throwing a rock at it while I was out. He would have to do this twice on separate occasions and inform me after the first that the next rock was coming. He had thrown the first rock while I was out grocery shopping. I had never heard of this odd sort of quitclaim maneuver. He explained that the only way for me to avoid losing my house was to be prepared to defend it, that is, not leave the house, with a bigger rock of my own. So I found one, the size and shape of a conch shell with many jagged edges, quite beautiful and dangerous looking, and was outside on my porch waiting. Mitch's girlfriend came along and began threatening me verbally. She came toward the house, but instead of a rock, she pulled a long knife, like a butcher knife, and ordered me to leave the house so she and Mitch could have it. Right then, two young women on bikes happened to pass by. I asked them to call the police. They recognized Mitch's girlfriend as the one who sold them drugs in front of the local school. If the police came, she knew she would be identified not only as a knife wielder. The covenant allowed only rocks in a fight of this sort, so this was a clear violation of the rules, but also as a drug dealer for school children, thereby losing her job and ending up in jail. I went into the house and phoned Mitch, explaining the standoff, and he called off the quitclaim fight. When I woke up, I was trying to decide whether I could trust him and his girlfriend enough to go to sleep in my dream house that night. Fortunately, I was able to go back to sleep in my real house on Bigelow Avenue here. No one, as far as I know, lurking outside with a rock trying to force me out. I'm guessing I could make some sense of this odd tableau if I tried hard enough. But I don't want to. Whatever my hidden brain or outer aura wanted me to learn from this, if anything, will, I know, get accomplished without any intervention in the form of work on my part. So I'm going to stop rowing now. The sun will be up in about 20 minutes. Mitch and his girlfriend are nowhere in sight. Merry and gentle will be my bywords this morning while I walk by the water, which I hope will be very calm. Part 4. One corollary of all this might be that our dream life, while we're asleep, has a reality to it that is equal to our daily ventures in the world, except that it taps into a vaster reservoir of images and orchestrates them not according to the strictures of temporal sequence, the way we remember our autobiographical lives, but according to some asynchronous, synthetic, generative scheme. All of this extraordinary visionary activity constitutes a life of its own, our own, whether we remember it or not, perhaps shaping us just as powerfully, if not more so, than what we do wakefully. One of the things I've learned from sharing early editions of this book with others is that many people don't remember much about their dreams. A few don't remember anything. That was a revelation to me. As I've explained in I'm Into Something Good, I wake up often during the night and remember whatever dream has been ongoing in quite vivid detail. I usually stop for a moment to decide whether it is one I want to come back to for more reflection. If so, I take a few notes as a mnemonic. The rest, the vast majority, seem to me to be just bizarrely arcane and colorful spectacles, resistant to interpretation, and not worth remembering consciously. Often, I can't begin to imagine how my brain could have invented them. They are, in their details, so far removed from my own autobiographical experience. Occasionally, I feel like I'm actually having someone else's dreams. These dreams I don't take note of disappear completely into oblivion. But I don't think they are unremembered. They just enter memory along a different trajectory, through embodied imagination instead of through the conventional senses. The fact that I happen to remember so many of my dreams may be outside the norm, at least among the cohort that reads my work. I'm quite sure, though, that having human brains like mine, they do dream the same amount and just as vividly. So where do all those dreams end up memory-wise? It seems ludicrous to believe that evolution has created a system that uses all of this energy, enough so that our brains need to disconnect from our bodies to keep us from enacting our dreams, toward no purpose. And it seems plausible that remembering all of that business, even if not consciously, is somehow crucial to their purpose or to our survival. Which to me suggests there is another sort of memory system expressly devoted to this material. One quite distinct from our conscious memories and from embodied processes like kinesthesia or proprioception. There is a contested term called body memory that psychologists use to think about the various ways memory enters the body outside of the normal conscious pathways and remains stored there in much the same way as it does in the brain. The only element of that argument I take interest in here pertains to trauma, which induces a super powerful memory akin to a bad dream, one we have repeatedly while waking, or suffer repeatedly as we sleep. Some therapists theorize, and there is anecdotal evidence to support them, that trauma of this sort is stored not just in the brain, but in the body, causing a variety of incidental problems. Eastern philosophies are much more confident and comfortable with that way of thinking about embodied memory. A whole range of practices, from meditation to yoga, expressly depend on it, using the body itself as a venue for learning and change. Part 5. I've gradually come to believe that we both learn and change while we sleep. And I don't mean the everyday housekeeping that some neuroscientists believe is the function of dreaming. The computer-like brain moving bits of data around into long-term storage locations to promote efficient access or deleting a bunch of extraneous stuff to prevent overload. I'm pretty sure the brain is powerful enough to do most of that kind of housekeeping in real-time relationship with experience. I mean, like the kind of learning we study and go to school for during our waking hours. Except in this case, what I called our background brain, and I'm into something good, does all the work for us out of our conscious awareness. I have no evidence for this, of course, but it is just otherwise too hard for me to explain why all that astonishingly inventive activity is going on beneath our attention. And this background brain work may be happening not just at night, but all the time. Sometimes erupting into what we call mundanely daydreaming, for example, when we're bored. Or creative work that so often seems to come out of nowhere, unbidden, a process that, as I've said, feels more and more involuntary the older I get. Or even hallucinatory visions akin to the ones Aboriginals experience in the Everywhen. There may also be vast amounts of it that simply can't make it up through the sensory noise of wakefulness. At one extreme, it is even possible to believe that our dream life is our real life, and our daily conscious life is just a sort of survival-related scrim that allows it to proceed. This inversion of realities has happened to me from time to time, as in this example from this fall. Just before I woke up, I had the most vivid dream of my life. Carol and I were sitting in bed together, having just returned from some work-related function out near the airport. Carol had been offered a low, mid-level job opportunity of some sort, and we were talking about it, as we often had, as she tried mightily but unhappily to situate herself in some professional capacity. She finally said she just didn't want to take it and looked up at me. Those beautiful blue eyes, simultaneously plaintive and hopeful, asking me, without ever saying anything, whether I would still love her if she were just her, not somebody in the world's eyes. I looked back at her instinctively, my eyes wet with emergent tears, almost mournful, that say, "I will always love you, to my utmost, from the bottomlessness of my heart, no matter what the world out there says or does about either one of us. Jobs, money, houses, cars, friends, fame, credentials, status, none of it means anything at all to me by comparison." All I said was, "Carol, I just want to be with you. That's all I ever wanted or ever will." Then I asked her, repeatedly, if this were real, if I was awake. She didn't answer, but I went through several testing stages. I rose up on my knees and shook my head as if to clear it, asking, "Am I really awake?" We were both still there. I pinched myself hard, asking again. We were both still there. I was thrilled, ecstatic. I was just about to tell her about a horrible nightmare I had had for months, that she was dead, gone, that I was alone. I couldn't contain my joy to know that finally it was over. When I opened my mouth to start speaking, I woke up. I was stunned and heartbroken to have to leave my dream reality for the nightmare of wakefulness. If you've ever had a dream of this sort, you know how it invites critique of the simplistic Western paradigm for orchestrating the status relationship between conscious imagery derived from sensory input and the various kinds of imagery that derives from on or sub or preconscious experience, from dreaming to creativity. And it calls into question our cultural tendency to valorize wakefulness and devalue dreaming. Maybe nocturnal experience is more real than diurnal experience. Many Aboriginal cultures seem to have no problem with that inversion, in some cases prefer it as a way of explaining where we came from and whatever the hell we're doing here. If you haven't ever had a dream of that sort, there's not much I can say, I'm sure, to persuade you to rethink your current notions about this. All I'll say, and it's in relation to this specific event, is that under the stress of certain kinds of trauma, deep grieving is a common one, our connection with everyday experience and reality is temporarily suspended. I entered another state of that sort for about 9 months after Carol died. Daily life took on the aura of a dream, something not quite happening to me, as my real life raged on just beyond the periphery of my awareness. Here's another passage from this fall that tries to explain it via TV imagery. Between February and November, I resided in a strange netherworld that is neither of this world nor of the next, whatever that might be. As I explained to a friend at a restaurant a few weeks after Carol died, I felt as if I were watching myself, my old self, on TV, in a series populated by all the characters I knew, for whom the ongoing narrative went on, normally. But the real me was now outside the plane of that reality, simply a viewer. My character in the program, I could see, was not a very good actor, forgetting his lines, mucking up the storyline. The writers would have to get him out of the script soon. The me watching, on the other hand, was on fire. Full more of rage than of words, that feeble currency of human experience. But like most of us when we watch TV, so captivated by those moving pixels without an identity of his own. And the rest of the cast was, of course, as oblivious to him as characters on TV are of us, sitting in our living rooms watching them. When that disconnection takes effect, I believe our brains are wise enough to replace the reality we've been dislocated from with one that is equally vivid and much more in keeping with our expectations of what life in this world needs to be at that moment, providing us with a therapeutic bridge, a way to sustain sanity until we wander back to a more conventional reality. But there's more to it than that. Once you've experienced such an interlude, conventional reality will forever look like a very thin veneer, one that we humans often cling to as a way to avoid contacting actual reality, which is so much deeper, more complex, and awesome than the one we prefer to believe in while we are putatively awake. This diurnal mirage is not necessarily a bad dream in the sense of being scary, more a flimsy and infirm dream, bad in the sense that we are culturally conditioned to believe it's really all there is. I could go on and on about this via multiple strange experiences I've had, not only since my wife passed, but for my whole life. But I won't. I just invite you to think whether in your own experience there have been events or perceptions that you dismissed as mere dreams, good or bad, when you could just as easily have welcomed them and installed them in your memory as foundationally true encounters with what's real.